Hello, friends, and welcome to the sixth episode of my tracking series on the Wilderness and Wellness podcast. And in this episode, I had the awesome privilege to sit down and talk about bird language and animism with tracking author, instructor, and podcaster Philip Tkachuk. Phil teaches us the intricacies of bird language, sharing foundational principles, stories, and examples of how we can tap into and become a part of the communications of nature. The following topics and more are discussed: the art of bird language, what it is, how it works, and how we can learn the secrets of the landscape using it, the specifics of bird vocalizations and what they mean, how bird language fits into the art of tracking, a few stories from Phil and I about our experiences with bird language and interpreting the mechanics of what the birds are saying with their vocalizations and behavior within those stories, animism as it relates to communications in the natural world, the practice of interspecies honoring, which is species giving space to one another, and how we can practice honoring with other animals as part of being in relationship with nature. The concept of reciprocity with the land as all species give and take, and how this relates to humanity's current state of relationship with the land, and how to begin learning bird language and building reciprocity-based relationships with the natural world. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Wilderness and Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Ron Wallin. This podcast is an exploration of the ways that people can reconnect to the natural world through bushcraft, naturalist skills, and time spent immersed in the nature they find around and within them. We also discuss how this reconnection can increase our individual well-being and that of our communities and the earth. Thank you for joining me. I'm really glad you're here. Hello, friends. I'm really glad you're here with me, and I'm really excited to share this interview that I did with Phil Tkachuk. Phil and I connected about a year ago or so. I happened upon his podcast and was just really enamored by it, and knew of him in the tracking world, and had previously picked up his book on reptile and amphibian tracks and sign, and was just very impressed with it, and just seemed like a really, really stellar human being. And so we connected and, kind of discussed getting together on a podcast episode, and he was so gracious to come on. And we actually recorded this quite a bit ago this last spring, but I was going over it recently to edit it for release. I was just really blown away by the content of this episode and really excited to put it out to you, because man, we get into some really, really awesome, awesome things. And Phil just does a wonderful job of breaking down the mechanics of bird language, and most importantly, what that means for us, you know, how we can tap into and be a part of the natural world and build relationships with other beings on a very deep and intuitive level. And so just really excited to bring this to you. So just a little bit about Phil. Philip is an experienced naturalist who has extensively studied the ecosystems of Washington State for over a decade. He is certified as a track and sign specialist through CyberTracker, holds a permaculture design certificate, and earned a Bachelor's of Science in Wildlife Science from the University of Washington. Included in his experiences as a naturalist, he has led bird walks with Seattle Audubon and taught tracking and outdoor skills to adults and youth for various organizations such as the Wildlife Society. Philip has also worked with the Olympic National Park conducting bat research, and for the University of Washington leading an in-depth study on nutria in the Seattle area. He is also a professional nature photographer who has captured wildlife images around the world. He is the author of Tracks and Sign of Reptiles and Amphibians through Stackpole Books, and a co-host for the Animism Listening to the Land podcast, which of course I highly recommend. So without further ado, here is my discussion with Phil. Enjoy. So yeah, thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate having you. It'll be fun to talk about this.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you and to share with everyone listening in.
Awesome. Good deal. So let's start off by having you tell us about your journey into connection with the natural world and all that.
Yeah. Well, You know, I think I've had a couple of pivotal moments in my life that really kind of set me on the path of nature connection. And I know in a previous conversation, you and I talked about, you know, how the book The Tracker impacted both of us.
And, right.
And how, yeah, it really opened my eyes to realization that I wasn't the only one that was that excited about the natural world. You know, and also wanting to like have that depth of knowledge and that depth of understanding and connection. So I think finding that book in my late high school years was very impactful. Also as a later adult coming across some other authors, including like David Abrams and Robin Wall Kimmerer. Well, I'd love to talk about a little bit later when we come around to
the topic. Yeah, absolutely.
And then also John Young, you know, John Young's book, What the Robin Knows, which is kind of the essential book on bird language is a great one, you know.
Definitely. Good deal. And so did you, you know, did you have a background with spending a lot of time in nature as a kid, or did you have, you know, parents that were, you know, doting in that way or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, my mom and my grandparents from a very early age, took me on walks and encouraged my interest in the natural world. I definitely, you know, got very excited about seeing, you know, bumblebees on poppy flowers. Tadpoles and puddles, and also when my mom, you know, did have the opportunity to take me to a zoo, I also got very excited about the animals I saw there. And so, yeah, and I think, you know, I immigrated into the U.S. when I was six, so my experience of landscapes changing also definitely kind of impacted me and my interest in. And yeah, when I came to the States, there's just so much more large areas of wild country, you know, in a lot of Europe, a lot of the terrain is rural or very fragmented. And so, yeah, my experience of wild places here has been very eye-opening, and I continue to have a deep appreciation for just how much wild lands we have in the state.
Yeah, we're very fortunate for sure. That's it's a real blessing. And, you know, part of this whole conversation, you know, from a broad bird's eye view perspective, pun not intended, but, you know, just the idea that it's important for us to conserve these lands so that we can continue to have these experiences and opportunities, and not just for us, of course, which of course we'll get into a little later, but for the benefit of the species and the lands themselves, because they are in fact, doing their own things that have nothing to do with us. So we'll get into that a little later, but yeah, so very good. And how did you become interested in tracking specifically?
Well, you know, I think when I was, I lived in California for a period of time, my youth, and, you know, I would come across the tracks of certain creatures. I think I saw coyote tracks. I think I saw my first mountain lion track when I lived down there, and I was definitely interested in animal tracks, but at the time, I didn't really have any community or resources or mentors to really give me a sense of how to study tracks. And, you know, it wasn't until I came to Washington State, and I've been here about 20 years now, that I started to run into people that were actually out doing this. You know, they were actually out tracking. They were looking at the different sign that animals leave behind and trying to identify them. They were trying to follow the trails of animals and find the animals. And I made friends with a variety of people. Initially, I think it was with the tracking community around Wilderness Awareness School. And one of my first tracking mentors, actually Jen Wolf, was really impactful. You know, we actually ran some courses. This is when I was working on my bachelor's of science. I was part of the Wildlife Society at the University of Washington, and my fellow members actually asked me to run a tracking class for them every year on this trip that we would take up into the mountains. And what was really interesting is, you know, I never really saw myself as being, you know, good enough to teach. And mostly I was just really excited to learn, but being put in that position really changed my trajectory of my life. When you have to teach a skill, you have to know it on a different level. You know, you have to be able to use your words and use your actions and demonstrate to people your ideas. And so that really brought my tracking to another level. And we were actually very lucky with where we were tracking with this group of people, because we were in an area where mountain lions were regularly seen. And I think one of the first trips we found literally in the driveway to this cabin in the snow, we found the trail of a mountain lion dragging a deer.
Oh, wow.
And
how fun.
So that was really incredible, you know, and I was just laughing to myself about how lucky these people are. The first time they go tracking, they get to trail a cougar that just killed. Like, that sets the bar really high, you know?
Yeah, they don't know how good they have it.
So, you know, all those moments really, really impacted me. When I was in college, I was working on a degree in wildlife science. So originally I was going to be a field biologist, but because of those experiences with teaching a little bit and getting mentored, I realized that I'd much rather be out there teaching and changing people's minds in that way. So when I finished my degree, I actually pursued teaching, and I ended up teaching for another outdoor school for about a decade. Had the opportunity to teach tracking and bird language and various different ways of connecting to the natural world. So yeah, I'm really grateful for those opportunities, and I still do try and teach when I can. I'm currently working a little bit for the school near Bellingham, which is called Raven's Roots Naturalist School.
Very good. That's awesome. Yeah, there's something profound that happens to the teacher when they have to teach a subject, especially one that they're perhaps not comfortable with teaching or feel that they know enough. There's a bit of a imposter syndrome thing that happens there, but the learning is exponential. At least that's been my experience, and you know, which relays with your story as well. That having to teach a subject is really makes you pay attention on a whole different level. So for all those trackers or wannabe trackers out there who really want to advance in this skill, take a note from Phil's story there. Look for opportunities to be uncomfortable with having to teach.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think, Ron, I think you're giving great advice, and really be willing to be wrong too.
Yeah. That's a huge part of tracking. And, you know, it's about finding the truth, and the truth is the truth, regardless of what you think. And anyway, yeah, that's a whole nother subject. But yeah, being willing to be wrong is huge, and it's a really big part of tracking, and a really, really big part of teaching. We've all had teachers at some point in our lives, I'm sure, that are on one spectrum or another, like a teacher that really has a teacher's heart and is really a learner at the same time along with the students, and then you know, the type of teacher that's more of a, you know, more authoritarian, and there's a huge difference in those two. And we all know, I feel, what we would prefer to have as a type of teacher when we're learning a subject. So for sure, thank you for that.
Definitely, I agree with you. And yeah, and it's interesting when I think back to you know, before I started encountering other trackers.
Sorry, Phil, the wind, it sounds like, is picking up again. I can hear it, the splotchiness in your voice again.
Oh, I'm sorry. That must be the internet connection.
Okay.
Yeah. I was just saying that, you know, it just reminds me of how when I was initially learning tracking on my own, I had this sense that I knew a lot. And then when I started to get the opportunity to track with other people, I very quickly realized, actually, that's not true. And when I tried to communicate some of what I knew and how I knew what I knew, then I started to really get a closer look at my own, you know, actual knowledge. And yeah, it was it's very humbling. Tracking and bird language can be very, very humbling. And I love that personally. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it definitely keeps one grounded for sure. And I feel it keeps one, for me, I'll say this for me, it keeps me very much in learning mode because the second you think you know something when tracking, you find out you don't. You know, no matter what level you're at, there's something that's going to throw you somehow or another. And it's a very introspective art. So
that's right.
Definitely. Cool. So explain to us what this thing called bird language is. You know, when we hear this term thrown around quite a bit, and you know, it's been my understanding that it's kind of the term itself was born in kind of, you know, North America, but the practice of it has been practiced throughout the ages for just about all cultures and peoples and all that. So tell us what this thing is that we call bird language here in North America.
Yeah. So bird language is really the study of communication that happens on the landscape. And we call it bird language because the most dominant voices in that chorus, in that grand conversation on the landscape, are generally bird voices, but not really accurate to just say it's bird language, because bird language also includes the sounds that are made by other animals. So frogs and squirrels and deer and all sorts of animals that are communicating on the landscape, and all of them, even across different species, are actually tuning in to each other and picking up information that's vital to their survival. So as an example, where I'm sitting right now, there are several robins that are alarming, and they're all facing in the same direction. And about, oh, I don't know, about 30 seconds ago, a red-tailed hawk flew by.
Oh, and nice.
The timing couldn't be more perfect, actually.
Yeah, thank you, red-tailed hawk and robins.
And so what's happening is that, you know, these robins are letting not just other robins know, but pretty much everyone within earshot, that there's a hawk hunting right now. And so if you are, let's say, a rabbit, like a eastern cottontail down in the valley here below me, and you hear that robin alarming, you're going to hide in the blackberry thicket, because if you don't pay attention, then that hawk might use that opportunity of inattentiveness on your part to catch you. So it's this really incredible thing that's happening all the time. And it, you know, initially, if you've never heard of this phenomenon, it sounds kind of far-fetched and almost magical, but it's really just something that is happening all the time. It's a natural phenomenon, and it's actually something we are part of as a creature. And as you mentioned, this is historically part of everybody's ancestral cultures to some degree. And it's interesting because you can go to certain parts of the world. You could go to, you know, hang out with the San Bushmen in Southern Africa, or you could go to other places in the world, parts of India, where people still practice this. And especially in landscapes where there are very large, dangerous animals, this kind of tuning in can literally save your life. So with the San Bushmen, you know, they know when the lions are nearby, or the hyenas, or, you know, the rhinos, or, you know, creatures that could be hazardous to their people, to if they're encountered in a, you know, too close of a proximity. So, yeah, so this kind of learning and this kind of tuning in can be fun and can be educational, but it can also be life-saving, and it can be very, very important to people, and has been to our ancestors.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you said earlier, and I think it's true, that for someone from a modern cultural existence, like most of the people this podcast is going to, who's not familiar with this, it does sound far-fetched. But when you put it in terms of survival for people, as far as knowing what the dangers are, and then also extrapolating that to thinking about the birds themselves, you know, and just putting your mind in the mind of the bird and thinking about having to survive in this world, you know, we are very removed from that type of thing in our modern existence. We're not so much concerned with the thing around the corner that's going to kill us at any moment, because there's very few of that, other than in perhaps some very particular places where those dangers might exist, you know, such as in crime areas and things like that. But think about this bird, you know, that perhaps it's a bird that's 3 years old. That's a bird that spent 3 years dodging daily attempts on its life, you know, and yeah, with those experiences of dodging that, there's a certain knowledge that comes with that. And these birds are, and all these animals that participate in this are extremely wise, and they have a lot of knowledge and wisdom to impart to us. And they're giving it to us all the time. It's just up to us to tap in and to hear it and to understand and start seeing and learning the nuances of these things that these birds and other animals are saying. And so, yeah, I just wanted to kind of put that out there for people who do have a hard time kind of understanding this. Like, it's a real thing. And I think John Young once said something about, it's like Freddy Krueger, you know, being around all the time and learning how to, that's what these birds are dealing with. They're dealing with basically murderers that are after them at any moment, you know. And of course, they're not thinking of the predators in a, you know, in an evil way, because they're just doing predator things. They're doing what they do. But that's from the perception of the birds that are trying to avoid getting killed. That's what it's like for them. You know, I can imagine just trying to stay alive. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's, and you know, something really important that I like to tell my students is that, you know, when you see a robin and a red-tailed hawk like I just did, those birds are not strangers to each other, right? They know each other quite well,
right?
So the predator isn't necessarily like some alien that shows up out of nowhere. Like,
right.
and that's part of why bird language works, why it's, you know, why it's so effective, is that when that hawk is full, it's already fed, the robins will act differently towards it than when it's hunting. Hmm. And for them, that's not a, you know, a hobby. That is life and death, right? Like,
absolutely,
they need to, is full and is not interested in pursuing any creatures for food. And so for them, they're constantly tuned into that. And for us, we're lucky enough to be able to learn how to tune into that language and actually glean meaning from it and enjoyment from it too. Like, I love being able to walk through a landscape or sit in a landscape and then hear an alarm and be like, oh, there's something happening. And if I tune in just right, oftentimes I can sort out who's doing what and where, and it's really fun. It's really exciting. It enriches our lives quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just, it helps us be a participant in what's going on. And of course, we'll get into that later a little more, but it just really, as you said, and I totally agree, it just totally enriches our experience out there and knowing what's going on out in the land. It's just so fun. It's just so fun. So how does this skill of being able to tap into these communications, how does it relate to tracking? They seem like pretty separate things. So how do we put them together?
Well, you know, so much of tracking is looking for evidence of animals on the landscape, and bird language is a form of evidence. So anytime a predator of some sort moves through a landscape, they set off a chain reaction in the bird language. And so, you know, we can use bird language in different ways to actually go hand in hand with tracking. So for instance, if we're, let's say we're in a really dense part of the forest here where I'm at in the Pacific Northwest. You know, you're in a thicket of salmonberries and devil's club, and you maybe you can't see more than 25, 30 feet. And you hear some very persistent alarms low down in this thicket. You're going to be able to guess, you know, from that location and from how that alarm moves and what species are participating in that alarm, you're likely going to be able to guess it's going to be one of several potential predators. And then you can walk over there and you can look for tracks and sign of that predator. So, you know, I can give an example of my life where I've done that before, where I heard, you know, an alarm in a very similar situation, and happened to be in a spot where there was some muddy patches, and I found fresh bobcat tracks. So, you know, those two things go hand in hand. That bobcat was literally setting off those bird alarms right when I was there, and it snuck away without me seeing them, but I did see the effect that the bobcat had on the birds, and I saw their tracks. So it's almost as good, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. And so, you know, we're talking about these terms, you know, alarm and things like that. So maybe especially for the listeners that aren't familiar with this, walk us through the mechanics of that. Like what does a bird alarm look and sound like? And then you talked about also how the birds, you could tell what the animal could be by the way they react. So could you maybe give us an example, or maybe just something that you've seen and you just kind of did give us an example, but maybe just more of the mechanics of what that looks like.
Yeah. So I think I have to lay down a little bit of information as background.
Please.
And I think I really like using the language that John Young created around it. So he basically describes five voices of the birds. And this is a very sort of reductionist way of talking about it, because, you know, there are birds out there that have way more vocalizations than just five.
Right.
But what he's trying to do is he's trying to simplify it by creating basically two categories of types of vocalizations. And I'm going to list the five voices, and then I'm going to explain how they're two categories. So the first one would be song. So very often we'll hear birds singing, especially this time of year in the spring. And, you know, that's a behavior mostly done by males. They're mostly singing to proclaim where they are, that they're healthy. They might be looking for a mate, or they might be proclaiming their territory. And so there's a lot of information in a song, but the song is not a vocalization birds do when they're scared of a predator. They're very comfortable when they do that.
Right.
And another vocalization is companion calls. So when you have a flock of birds, or maybe a mated pair of birds, like a male and a female robin, or two sparrows, they're going to be vocalizing back and forth as they feed. Or maybe the female might be sitting on a nest and the male is out foraging to bring back food, and they'll be vocalizing on and off as a way to keep in touch. Again, that's not an alarm. Those birds are relaxed and they're just trying to maintain contact with each other. And then the third vocalization would be male-to-male aggression. So in this case, generally it's male-to-male. Occasionally it's female-to-female. But usually what this is there are two males that are chasing each other around and they're having a little territorial dispute. Now, sometimes that sounds pretty intense, and the vocalizations can be loud, and you can hear the wings are flapping around, and they're kind of chasing each other around in circles, and there might even be some physical aggression. But if you look around at the other birds, they're going to be completely ignoring those two males. They're going to be relaxed. So That is not a kind of alarm, right? It's just those two males are having it out and the other birds don't really care.
Right. they are.
So that still counts as what we would call a baseline behavior. And the fourth one is also baseline behavior. And this is a sound we're going to start hearing around in my neck of the woods in probably about a month or so.
We're but actually hearing some it here.
Yeah, you guys are ahead of us.
But, yeah, down in Arizona.
Called juvenile begging. So actually, my partner Grace and I today, we saw two baby Anna's hummingbirds that were almost ready to fledge. So,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so they're right. But basically, this vocalization is made by baby birds that are either still on the nest or recently left the nest. And so they are begging for food. And again, if you're not sure if the sound they're making is an alarm or not, you can always check by watching the other birds in the area. Because if you hear some kind of, you know, kind of sharp, loud sound coming out of a bird, and you look around and the other birds are still relaxed and feeding, then that is not an alarm. And really often with juvenile begging, if you see the bird, it'll be a baby bird. It'll often not have its feathers fully developed, or if it does, it's going to spend a lot of time just sitting in one place, opening its mouth, making lots of noise, and shaking its wings too. A lot of baby birds will shake their wings over their back to beg for food. So all of four of those are still what we call baseline behavior, right? So that's the first category. But the last one, which we haven't mentioned yet, is alarm. And alarm is a non-baseline behavior. So basically, when true alarm happens, it could be started by a single bird making an alarm note, or it could be multiple birds. But essentially, it's a call that lets everybody know that there's a predator nearby and that danger is present. And so everyone will immediately stop what they're doing and give their attention to that. And if the predator is close enough, they might actually bail into the bushes or into the closest cover, or they might flee out of the area, depending on what the predator is. So, you know, this kind of behavior might take a little practice to notice, but it's something that even us, you know, very, very civilized urban humans have some relationship to this, because if you watch a scary movie and someone's walking into the woods and all of a sudden all the crows fly out of the trees, something bad's going to happen, right?
Right, right.
So we do have that like very basic relationship with that, you know, if all the birds suddenly flee and start, you know, vocalizing a lot, or if all the birds go dead silent, which is actually a form of alarm too, then we know something is up.
And the silence would indicate that they don't want whatever it is that's around knowing their location. So they're just going to sit tight and be quiet.
Exactly. Exactly. So for me around here in the forest, most often it's going to be a Cooper's hawk that causes that sort of alarm where all of a sudden, you know, I was hearing birds singing and all of a sudden all the birds are quiet. There's no birds out. All the birds are hiding in cover and they're being very quiet. Because they know if they vocalize that Cooper's hawk is going to focus in on them and pursue them. So, yeah, sometimes it pays to be very still and quiet if your potential predator is nearby.
Very good. Cool. And so could you, do you have a story for us on, you know, maybe an experience that you had with bird language? You tell one and then I'll tell one. How about that?
Yeah, I've got so many.
I'm sure you do.
Well, yeah, actually, I can tell one from today. So, I was walking on a wetland boardwalk with my partner Grace, and there were two events that happened that were bird language related that happened relatively quickly in succession. The first one was we were walking along the boardwalk and there were different birds feeding around the boardwalk and even going across the boardwalk. There was a towhee and a song sparrow and some chickadees and some bush tits. And all of a sudden they all disappeared. And I heard this really high note call being made by a brown creeper, which I hadn't even seen the brown creeper. And when we looked up, a merlin had flown by very quickly.
Oh, wow.
Over the trees. And now merlins are these small falcons that are very specialized in eating birds. And so everybody hid.
Right.
The one that vocalized was the brown creeper. And I think that they were probably very well camouflaged. So
definitely. And
it was interesting because then within a couple of minutes, all the birds came back out and settled back down because the merlin just passed over very quickly. They didn't stop and hunt that area. Mm. But even that bird passing by was enough to create that sudden change in behavior. And then the other little moment that happened just a little bit further down was there was a crow picking up nesting material from near the top of a dead willow. And all of a sudden, a female's Anna's hummingbird came and attacked the crow.
Oh, wow.
And that seemed like a out of the blue behavior. But what's happening is that female is protecting her nest that's hidden right in that area. And so hummingbirds can be very aggressive little birds. People don't realize that, but they're little warriors.
Yeah.
And so right for this crow, and the crow immediately took off and fled out of there. So both of those are types of bird language events, right?
Yeah.
In that crow was a potential predator of this hummingbird nest. Okay. I'd love to hear your story.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, so before I tell mine, I'd like to deconstruct that a bit as far as the behavior, because we've talked about vocalizations, but you know, you talked about how birds act different ways depending on what the predator is. So for instance, the merlin, which, you know, is a, what would you call it? Like a ambush predator, is sweeping through and trying to quickly grab something before it knows it's even there. You know, it sounds like that was a quick note and then kind of a dive and hide type of thing, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And so, but the crow on the other hand, or the raven, that was more like attack and try to repel. So, you know, if someone's out in the woods, for instance, and they hear like a quick note, everything goes silent and the birds are nowhere to be seen. You know, that's probably not indicative of like a coyote or a fox moving through. It's probably indicative of an aerial predator that specializes in birds. Is that
that's
a fair
right.
assumption?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assumption. And I found that to be pretty consistent around here. One of the scariest creatures to birds around here is one of our smallest predators, which is the pygmy owl.
Oh.
They create such a huge effect on the bird language. It's amazing. You would think there was like a Siberian tiger moving through the landscape, but no, it's this little owl that's the size of a tennis ball. And the birds just freak out when the little owl.
That's funny. Very good. Well, that's great. Those are good stories, because mine is going to contrast a little bit and it's going to kind of demonstrate a different type of bird language behavior. So one morning I was sitting at my sit spot, which was this really beautiful area in the high Colorado Plateau Desert, just outside of Page, Arizona, which is where I was living at the time, and just on the outskirts of town. And there was this really nice little ribbon of riparian area, and riparian refers to sort of a, you know, a watery, like a stream or a creek or something like that. And with the typical vegetation of that kind of ecosystem, which in this case was willows and some more invasive tamarisk and Russian olive and whatnot, but just this nice little ribbon running through this kind of high Colorado Plateau Desert. And so my sit spot was situated within the desert, kind of overlooking this little ribbon of riparian habitat. And it was a late spring. And over the course of that spring, I'd gotten pretty familiar with some coyotes in the area that had been raising pups inside that riparian thicket. And a lot of cool stories there. But I was sitting there one day at my anchor point, which is kind of the one spot you sit in at your sit spot. And the sun was just barely coming up. Like, it was still pretty dark, but light enough you could kind of see what was going on, but very dim. And so it was even before the birds were really, really, really going to town at this point. So it was really dim, and off in the distance, not too far, but probably, you know, half a mile, three quarters of a mile away, I hear this coyote howl. And I heard that howl, and of course I really tuned into it just because I love the sound of the coyotes. And then out of nowhere, no birds were going or anything at that point, but I hear something fluttering around in the riparian thicket, and I couldn't quite see it, but I could see the silhouette of it, but I couldn't see like what kind of bird it was, but it was a larger bird. And it went up on the branch about 6 feet, six or seven feet high, and it started alarming. And one thing for those who aren't familiar with an alarm, it's one of those things where it's often even more than just a sound or the visual behavior of what the bird's doing. You can kind of feel it in your chest once you become familiar with it. Like, you know, like you can feel the tension in the bird's voice and that they're very concerned about something. And so this bird started alarming, and I could kind of feel that. And so I'm relaying this story, but it happened very quickly. So the coyote alarms, the coyote howls. About 5 seconds later, I hear this rustle. I see this bird go up about 6-7 feet and start alarming. And then at that point, I was like, okay, I know what's happening here. And literally about 5-6 seconds after the bird started alarming, this coyote trotted out right out of the thicket right under it. And so the story that happened there to me is that, you know, the coyote howled in the distance, and then the bird went off because this other coyote in the thicket was going to come out and respond. And that's exactly what happened. The coyote came out, pushed the bird up in the tree. The bird started alarming. And once the coyote was out of the thicket, it started howling back to the one that initiated it all. So it was just a fun little story. And it was just kind of neat that, at that point in my tracking and bird language journey, it was just really kind of neat for me to be able to kind of know what was going to happen based on how the bird acted, just because it came up that certain height, it alarmed, and I was familiar enough with the area to know that those coyotes were around, and in the thicket quite often. And so that was really fun for me. And so to kind of deconstruct that one, you know, in this case, the bird, it wasn't, you know, a quick chirp and duck and cover, because it's not hiding from an aerial predator. In this case, you know, it's a land-based predator. And so, and now we get into the idea of conservation of energy, which is an important aspect for wild things, because they're on a really limited energy budget. You know, they only have as much energy as they can find in the form of food. And so they're very careful with that energy. So a bird's not going to completely fly away when it's very familiar with and understands the nature of the danger it's dealing with. And so in this case, the bird just went up high enough, so it knew it was out of reach of the coyote. So it saved its energy in that way, but it was still able to sit there, keep an eye on the danger, and let everyone else know about its presence. And so it just went high enough. So in that case, the coyote pushed the bird up into the thicket that certain height. And that told me that it was a land-based predator, of course. And in this case, I figured it was the coyote based on, you know, my knowledge of the area, but it could have just as easily been a bobcat or a fox or something of that nature too. So that's fun. Those are good stories.
That's great. And I would love to deconstruct your story just a tiny
Please
bit
do.
More.
Yeah.
Say that, you're reminding me of how important it is to know the land where you are, because, you know, you obviously you've spent time in that spot. You knew the coyotes, you knew some of the birds, and it helps to sort out the possibilities of who the predators are, even if you can't see them, because you're familiar with the place, right? So, for instance, where I was today in Seattle, which is, it's a place I've been going to for over 16 years now, and it's a little urban wild area. And, you know, in this place, there's a really high concentration of aerial predators. So like, it's really interesting, because if I go into, let's say, a more forested area here in the foothills rather than in Seattle proper, there's more likely to be land-based predators too. So it really makes a difference. And it's just a reminder to everybody listening that, you know, bird language is something that takes time, and, you know, give yourself time to learn, give yourself opportunity to learn your place, and remember that patience is part of the process too.
Definitely. And to remember that you're going to have questions, you're going to see things you have no idea what they are, and just sit with it, because the answer will show itself at some point, whether it's through another experience you have or someone you tell the story to that's able to, you know, elucidate on what happened or whatever. But yeah, that's been a constant for me in this whole journey of learning natural skills and tracking and bird language, is just sitting with questions, you know, seeking the answers, but being okay not getting the answer right away. Because when it comes, it's going to be powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had mysteries. I've had sacred questions that lasted for, you know, 10, 15 years sometimes.
Yes, so, indeed.
Out, you know, I was so happy. So yeah, sometimes you really have to earn that little nugget of knowledge and take your time.
Very good. Cool. So we also wanted to talk about this concept that we call animism. And Phil, if you want to kind of describe to us what that is, that would be great.
Absolutely. So this is something that has become more and more a part of my nature connection journey. And really, I think of it in part as an extension of bird language, because bird language requires that you humble yourself a little bit and that you open up to the idea that other beings other than humans are actually communicating in a meaningful way in the landscape. And with animism is really a practice of living in a respectful way with the living landscape, and understanding that, you know, all the beings around you to some extent are alive, aware, and have at least some ability to have meaningful exchange with you and with each other. Everything from insects and birds and mammals and fish to even to rivers and wind and trees. And I'm not saying that, you know, a tree is necessarily going to speak English to you, or the wind is going to speak English, or even the birds are going to speak English, but that doesn't mean that they aren't able to communicate in a meaningful way. And it's really something that, if you look back, just like with bird language, ancestrally, all of our ancestors had an animate relationship with the landscape. So they saw and they experienced the landscape as alive, aware, and responsive to them. And so it's this way of living life that it's living as a participant, right? And we kind of have to step back from this idea that we're superior beings and that we're, you know, we are the pinnacle of evolution in some fashion. It really forces you to set that aside and to live with an open mind, an open heart, and living as respectfully as possible. So how that relates to bird language is, you know, one of the things I try and practice is that when I move through a landscape, because I'm trying to be respectful to that landscape in for various reasons. You know, one is that I really love the places that I live in and I want to show my appreciation, but another reason I want to be respectful is when I move in a respectful way, I actually have a much richer experience. And so coming back to bird language, you know, if I see a robin feeding on the ground and a song sparrow and a towhee, and I notice them, I can stop and I can let them choose to move out of the way before I go further on a trail. And that way, you know, I'm showing them respect. They're already asking for that from me. And if you watch a bird feeding, very often they'll stop and they'll look at you and be like, "Hey, I see you. You're kind of making me a little uncomfortable." You know, they're expressing this through their body language. And so there's all these opportunities to move in a respectful way. And if I do that, maybe around the next bend in the trail, there will be, you know, a very shy creature that I've really wanted to see, one that would otherwise stay because it heard the bird alarms that I just caused. So that there's this real strong tie-in for me and just trying to move in a respectful way. I hope that makes sense. I can elaborate more too.
No, I really, yeah, I really see that tie between bird language and there's this practice that is often called the honoring practice, which you just basically talked about with, you know, giving distance and respect. And you see this in the natural world quite often. John Young tells a story about, and I forget the specifics, but, and I forget where he heard it or if he saw it firsthand or what, but about an elephant in Africa. And there was this like whole herd of elephants moving through this area. And there was a small, like plover-like bird that had its nest, as such birds do, on the ground there among the rocks. And as the elephants were moving through, it was obvious that they were going to move right over this nest and probably trample it. And of course, the mama bird with its eggs is kind of, you know, going kind of crazy and you know, going around the nest really fast and just kind of alarming because it foresees what could happen. And when the lead elephant came close enough to see this, it literally backed up and turned around and went around a different way and led the entire troop of elephants a different way. So here you have, you know, in this natural land, these two beings interacting in this way, and this huge, massive elephant, which, you know, could, if it wanted, just trample around and not have any concern for anything around it. Instead, it practices this natural law of honoring its fellow beings and noticing this bird and it's, you know, it's being upset over what could happen, and then literally taking the entire herd of elephants out of the way just for this one bird in its nest. And that's a very extreme example in the natural world. But like you said, you know, like that bird was asking for that respect from those elephants. These birds all around us are asking for the same thing, and all animals, I would say, to a large degree as well. And that's very, very profound way to move on the land.
Yeah, it really is. It's very transformative to have, you know, to open yourself up to, first of all, to considering that this is a way of moving and being in the world, and then actually practicing it. And that story with the elephant and the plovers, one of my favorite ones that I've heard from John Young. And, you know, and I think of where I live, I've seen many times when deer come out and they graze in a meadow and there are robins feeding on the ground, that the deer are very mindful not to just kick the robins up out of their way, but they actually kind of meander around them. And there's good reason for that, because those robins are very keen on what's going on and very tuned in. And, you know, they have sharper eyes than the deer do. And so they're gonna let those deer know if there's a predator approaching on the ground. And for the deer around here, the scariest predator is the cougar. Right. And so, you know, it pays for them to have allies, as many allies as possible, looking out for them. So yeah, so there's, you know, there's that very real world connective kind of relationship there.
Right. And then that gets into the idea of reciprocity, you know, this idea of working in relation with animals and receiving the benefits of that. So maybe if you could speak to that a little bit, just reciprocity, you know, what is it that we are gaining as people, as humans, as beings on the land, by building these relationships with these other wild beings?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's really important to consider how giving and taking is so much part of how the living world works. And I mentioned two authors earlier in this interview, in this podcast. One of them was Robin Wall Kimmerer, and her book Braiding Sweetgrass is a really incredible book on reciprocity, specifically on the reciprocity between people and plant. And, you know, I think it's really incredible to consider that, you know, it is possible to live in this world and eat from this world, which we have to, right? We have to consume life in order to live, but also do it in a way where we can be respectful. And, you know, there are all sorts of ways to give back, right? And I really rally against this idea that I hear very often from people that, you know, humans are just this awful destructive force in the world. I don't think that's true. I think that's more a cultural relic of, you know, how our particular culture lives in this world. But there's such a diversity of cultures around the world, and some cultures have a very deeply reciprocal relationship with the landscape. So, for instance, in my area where I live, the salmon are a huge, huge part of the native diet here. And the native people here, you know, are deeply, deeply appreciative and respectful of the salmon. And what's really amazing, I just read another really interesting book called Being Salmon, Being Human. And the author talks about how the Kalalam people, which is one of the tribes in my area, had the technology to literally catch every single salmon in the river. And they could have.
Wow.
But they did. They actually released most of the salmon and let them pass. And they did it out of respect because they knew that these salmon were giving their bodies to them, to, you know, to the human people and to the bears and to the trees. And, to, you know, the salmon are so vital to life around here. And, you know, that way of thinking is, it sounds almost ludicrous to people who are used to just extracting as many resources as possible from the landscape. So yeah, it's, you know, it is possible to live that way. It is possible to think that way and to practice being in relationship in that way. And, you know, I've had examples of that in my life where there was a pond I used to visit, very, very regularly, like many, many times during a year. And I realized that it was getting choked out by an invasive grass species. So I started actually putting in many hours of my own labor to pull this grass up and help some of the native plants. And I got to watch how the native plants rebounded in this area. And for instance, the wild mint got to spread and the water horehound and other plants. And I saw this amazing beauty come back, and it was just from me getting my hands dirty, you know, and like being willing to help be involved in the process of the ecology. And again, this is what animism is about. And this is what reciprocity is about, is we're participants, but in order to be participants in a healthy way, we have to be responsible for our effect and our actions.
Very much. Yeah. So how does this, you know, relational idea of having these deep and intimate relationships with the land, how does it relate to tracking specifically?
Yeah. So I think for me, you know, the first thing is that, and you mentioned this earlier, and I really love this idea that, you know, tracking gives us this insight into the minds and experiences of other beings. And there is, first of all, there is compassion and understanding that comes through there. You know, so if you're, let's say, tracking, you know, a deer or let's say a coyote or a raccoon, and you see what they go through to survive and how they have to live, there's a deep appreciation in you that grows from that experience, right? So there's that. And then there's also this sense of responsibility. You know, like I am right now in my life, I'm really focused on deer and elk and getting to know them better. And I'm actually trying to participate in hunting them. Mm. And that's a whole nother complex relationship of reciprocity, because I love deer and elk. So this isn't me trying to dominate an animal. This is me trying to participate in a really beautiful way. But one of the things that I often consider is that, you know, I like trailing them, which means following their tracks, but you have to do it in a responsible way, because as you mentioned, wild animals live such tight lives energetically. Like if in the middle of winter I follow a deer and I scare it out of its bed, you know, it's burning these calories that it doesn't really have to burn. And so I don't want to do that. I don't want to impact them in that way because I love them. I genuinely love them. You know, I love these creatures and all the animals that I track, like I have a really deep connection to. And so there's just a natural affinity that grows with the animals that you track. You know, sometimes it's they're near mythical creatures, you know, like where I live, wolverines are like the unicorns, basically. They're so few of them in our mountains. And you, once in a while you might cross their trail, and but just seeing their tracks is incredible. You know, it's like being reminded that there's these incredibly shy wild creatures that are so unique and incredible, and you know, seeing their tracks is almost as good as seeing them. You know, it's a reminder that they're present in the landscape. Yeah. And that it's just it's an incredible thing. Like I got to see some of the last woodland caribou tracks. This was like 15 years ago when it was still heard in Washington State. And I actually followed them for a little ways. And it was very recently, I think it was in the last year or two, that the woodland caribou actually went extinct in Washington State, which is really heartbreaking, you know, and it definitely hit me on a personal level because I'd had a relationship with these animals. And so, yeah, tracking gets you involved in your ecology in a way that is participatory. You know, you can't just be an observer, because when you track an animal, you are involved in its life. And so, yeah, there's just a natural form of connection that happens there.
Absolutely. Very good. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, moving into the practical realm of this for our listeners, how can people, what can they do to begin learning bird language and learning how to start building relationships and reciprocity with the natural world?
Well, I think that a couple of things I will say that might be useful to all you listeners, especially to those of you who are just starting. You know, the first thing is it's really helpful to find a little green space near where you live and just spend time watching animals, watching birds. And, you know, along with that, I think it's really important to open your mind up to the idea that animals are having meaningful conversations in the landscape. Even if they're conversations you don't yet understand, those conversations are happening. And, you know, to what extent you want to believe they're having conversations is up to you. But even from a purely scientific standpoint, animals are exchanging information. Yeah, so I just encourage all you listeners to go and spend time watching birds where you can, and start by learning a few species, just the familiar ones, and get to know their behavior really well. I liked something that you said, Ron, when we were talking about our language stories, in that, you know, it helps to not only learn the bird's sounds, but also their body language, and also become familiar with how they feel, right? So there's this deep variance from what birds, and when a bird alarms, you'll feel it in your body. And I've definitely had that experience many times. So that's what I would encourage you to do. Pick up a copy of What the Robin Knows if you can. I would really encourage that. And yeah, and get yourself a bird identification app. I have Merlin on my phone, which I really love. That's a free bird app. But really, don't let yourself get overwhelmed by the number of species. Just start with the common ones around you and know them really well.
Wonderful. Awesome. Thanks, Phil. And I would just quickly add to that, you know, it's super easy to begin, you know, once you find, you know, a green space or something of that nature, a sit spot where you can start kind of practicing this, to start just doing some little honoring practices, you know, start nodding and saying a hello to different birds you come across or other animals, and try giving them space, you know, try walking widely around them, and or even just pausing and letting them go about what they're doing and just standing and watching. You know, that's potentially why one would be at a sit spot anyway, is to stand and watch, or stand or sit and watch wildlife. So definitely awesome. And I typically ask, what are two or more books that you might recommend? And you gave us one already, What the Robin Knows by John Young, and I would definitely second that. Are there any others you would suggest?
Yeah. Well, so I think there's a couple of books that might be helpful. So one of the authors that's really given me more language around animism has been David Abrams. And David Abrams, his book, Becoming Animal, is pretty potent. And he's got a whole chapter in there about bird language that pretty awesome. And then also I'm one for just, you know, stories of reciprocity of people and plants, and just ways of thinking that are based more in this sort of animate perspective. I'm trying to think of other bird language books, but to be honest, there aren't that many bird language books out there just yet.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. It's a subject that, it's so funny because it's very prolific within people that live close to the land. It's a prolific practice anyways, even if they don't have a specific name for it. But it's not something that's been really kind of talked about or understood until Tom Brown Jr.'s books, where he talks about a little bit. And then, of course, John Young really, really bringing that particular practice to us. So,
right. Yeah, I maybe if people want to hear a little bit more conversations about animism, they can check out the podcast that myself and my friend Nathan have put together too.
But yeah, I was definitely going to suggest that as well, for anyone that really does want to go deeper into this topic of relationship with the land. Check out Phil and his buddy Nate's podcast. It's really, really good. It's really well done. It's called Animism, Listening to the Land Podcast. And of course, I'll have the link to it in the show notes. So if anyone's interested in that, go check it out. And what are other ways that people might be able to connect with you and your work, Phil? I know you've got a wonderful book on Track and Sign out there for reptiles and amphibians, if you want to kind of talk about that real briefly.
Sure. Yeah. I can touch on that. So yeah, I spent a number of years putting together this tracking book. So it's the Track and Sign of Reptiles and Amphibians of North America. And it's in the same series as the mammal track and sign books and bird track and sign books and animal skull book, I think, that Mark Elbrock has put out, and his work is pretty incredible.
Absolutely.
So yeah. If folks are interested in more in tracking on reptiles and amphibians, then please check out my book. It was a really eye-opening, growing experience putting that book out there. And, I would love to hear more people, give me feedback on it too. It's one that I love being in conversation about as well.
Very good. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time, Phil. Thank you so much for coming on, and in the spirit of your podcast as well, a big thank you to all the wonderful beings and creatures out there that we get to speak about, because we have built relationships with them, and those whom we haven't and are yet to build relationships with, a big thanks to them and to all of our mentors and those who have given us this information and given us reason to go down this path. So thank you all. And thank you, Phil, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And thank you for voicing your gratitude to all of those beings. I'll second that. And also I want to put out a thank you to you, Ron, for having me on and for just making this conversation and this information available to other people. I deeply appreciate the work you do. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Phil.
Well, friends, that wraps up this episode of the Tracking Series on the podcast. A hearty thank you again to Phil for coming on and just really sharing all of his knowledge and wisdom with us. And if you're looking for more of that, definitely go check out his podcast. Having a lot of good feedback on this tracking series, and I owe a lot of that to my guests, of course. I've had some really amazing guests and definitely more to come. So stay tuned for that. And, but yeah, go check out Phil's stuff, check out his book, check out his podcast. He's just got a really, really fabulous way of teaching, and, he really has a gift for, connecting people to the natural world. And that's what this discussion and this podcast is all about. So, thanks again, Phil. As always, feel free to check us out on Facebook, Instagram. I post episode updates there. Definitely leave us a review if you can, wherever it is you're accessing this podcast, and especially on Apple Podcasts. We get reviews there from time to time. In fact, I got another review a few weeks back and really, really appreciate that. So even if it's just a few words, that's awesome. And if you want to get a hold of me, you certainly can do that to ron@coyotespath.com. I put all the information we talked about in the episode in the show notes, including how to connect with Phil. And he provided his email address as well, which is pathwithaheart@hotmail.com. And also some information on how to connect with his podcast on Facebook and Instagram, and also the link to his podcast, of course. So you can connect with Phil in that way. So definitely go check him out and all the work, amazing work that he's doing. And we'll continue to put episodes out on this podcast as well. So with that, we'll see you in the next episode. Happy trails.